This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Halfway through the Saturday edition of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, you're listening to TSN 1290, the Jets and the Avalanche tonight here on the station as part of Industrial Metals Winnipeg Jets Game Day. Drew Mandel, Dave Manuk, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and of course our website that has the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio. That's IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Pleased to welcome back to the program our very good friend from the Associated Press, Stephen Wino, joins us. Stephen, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Doing very well, Stephen. How are you?
I'm great.
Are you from Philly?
I'm from Philly originally, yes.
Are you cheering for the Eagles tomorrow night?
See, I'm a Jaguars fan, which is a complicated story, but I am going to watch the game in Philadelphia with friends. I wanted to be in the city. It's still the city I grew up in. So it's kind of an implicit emotion after the Jaguars and the Patriots last week, but it would be nice to see the city I grew up in win a championship.
So we can look for you climbing a lamppost in Philadelphia in case they win tomorrow evening.
You'll see that on the news. Yes.
Yes. Okay. We'll look forward to that. They grease them up, so be careful, of course.
Stephen, Drew wants to make a bet with you.
No, I don't. I'm a Vikings fan, so it's let sleeping dogs lie. How about that?
Let's talk some hockey.
Okay. Stephen, obviously, we're going to talk hockey with you. That's why we brought you on. I really enjoyed your article this week in the Associated Press about injury reporting in the NHL. And it's sort of funny that I started the interview with you with about an NFL question, because the NFL is so diligent in reporting the specifics of injuries. And a lot of people tie that to the impact of gambling on the NFL. Do you think that the NHL, maybe as a collective, needs to re-examine how they report injuries and say, you know, it's time for this cloak and dagger nonsense to be away with? I mean, we saw the Dallas Stars have started to be more forthcoming. Here in Winnipeg, Paul Maurice is forthcoming only about concussions. Is it time maybe for the NHL to have a league-wide mandate regarding injuries?
I don't sense that even close to happening. I think it's closer to going the other way and being less, fewer details about injuries and more of the undisclosed versus even upper and lower body injuries at this point. I sense no appetite, and this is from Gary Bettman and Bill Daly, or from the NHLPA, or from coaches or executives, of opening the door up to it, because everyone I've talked to around the league about this has almost essentially said, well, why do you need to know? We'll tell you whether someone's in or out, or a game day or a game time decision. Why does it matter whether it's a shoulder injury or an elbow injury or a wrist injury? And it's such a contrast from the NFL and even from the NBA and Major League Baseball, where these injuries are announced minutes essentially after something happened. Hey, Tom Brady is questionable return with a right ankle injury. It happens every single time, and the contrast makes the NHL look like it's in the dark ages for something like this. But the NHL is very comfortable being in the dark ages with this, which for those of us who cover the sport or who are curious about these sort of things, it's sometimes hard to understand, but I can't imagine this changing anytime soon.
Stephen, if you'll allow us to go back to Thursday night and the game between the Jets and Golden Knights and that controversial goal call, I know that you've seen it. And I'm not going to ask you whether or not you think that goal should have been allowed, but when you look at, you know, some of these goaltender interference calls and some of the goals have been allowed and some of the goals that have been disallowed, I mean, how is the NHL going to fix it and not let this be a problem come playoff time?
Well, this is the problem. I don't think the goal should have been allowed, but I understand, I guess, the fact that the slash was missed and you can't review it, and by the letter of the law, I guess I sort of understand it, but the inconsistency for goaltender interference from rink to rink, from officiating crew to officiating crew, has just baffled everyone. General Manager Doug Armstrong said this the other night. No one understands what goaltender interference is. And it's one of the reasons why the NHL was so reticent to put this in to begin with, is it's always been a gray area. There is a black and white rule book saying what goaltender interference is, but it matters on some level of interpretation about how much interference affects a goalie on a given play. One goalie could have a skates clip and could completely throw him off. One could be bumped and not be thrown off and make a save. Or it's so different from goaltender to goaltender, situation to situation, that I almost think the first step has to be going to make all these reviews to the central office in the NHL, the situation room that currently decides whether a puck is in or out, that there's a lot of stuff on Mike Murphy and those guys' plates already, and I understand the reluctance to want to do that, but I think that has to be the first step in kind of souping up the staffing there, maybe putting Kay Whitmore and some former goalies in charge of those kind of decisions in a central league office, so there's at least a little bit better of a standard. But I don't know how you fix this, because it's such a judgment call situation to situation, and you're always going to have disagreements. You're just, like with the offside, you're trying to get rid of the egregious calls that a goaltender gets bumped and an official misses it, and you're able to challenge it. Now you're getting into skate off the ice, offside type challenges on goaltender interference, and it's the slightest little bit where you can almost flip a coin on half these calls, whether it's a goal or not.
You know, Stephen, there were rumors of the demise of the Pittsburgh Penguins, but lo and behold, the two-time defending Stanley Cup champions have gone 8-2-0 and are sitting just 4 points back of Washington for first in the Metropolitan Division. You know, they still have a questionable away record from Pittsburgh at 10-14-2, but are the Pittsburgh Penguins kind of hitting it on all strides right now and looking like the two-time defending champs have gotten it back in the right way?
Yeah, they're flying right now, and seeing what they did to the Washington Capitals last night, And in a good counterpunch game. This was a game the Penguins led 2-0, and Capitals tied up, and they go basically goal for goal with the firepower the Penguins have and the depth of offense they can rely on again, which is what won them the Stanley Cup the past 2 years. Players in the division, they still have, I think they have the best team in the Metropolitan Division, because if Evgeny Malkin and Sidney Crosby and Phil Kessel are all healthy and all clicking, and you're able to spread those guys out onto different lines and still get some Brian Rust or Carter Rowney and those kind of guys to contribute. I mean, the power play is now clicking, I believe, at 27%. And I think one team in NHL history has gotten to 27% on the power play in a season. This could be the greatest power play we've ever seen in the NHL. That kind of offense is good enough that when you have Chris Letang and a lot of other guys who maybe have a little bit less experience beyond a guy like Justin Schultz on D, you can survive that. You can survive Matt Murray being out of the lineup for a little while and leaning on a guy like Tristan Jarry, because there's so much talent up front there. They've been able to score on the power play. They've now been able to score better at even strength recently over the past month or so. This is a team that sure looks primed for another at least run to the Eastern Conference Final.
Stephen Wino, our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Stephen covers the NHL for the Associated Press. Stephen, in the previous answer, you referenced the Washington Capitals, and you know, I don't think anybody's really talking about the Capitals, yet they're atop the Metropolitan Division, which is generally regarded as the second best division in the NHL. You know, is this maybe a benefit to the Capitals that for whatever reason they're flying under the radar, they're having their typically good regular season? Of course, for them, it only matters if they're able to finally put it together in the playoffs, but maybe the pressure isn't on the Capitals because nobody really expects anything from them come April?
I think it's helping right now that there's, since the so much of the roster turned over in the offseason, that there's less pressure on them, but they're still in first place, and if the Penguins don't catch them to win the division and the Capitals are in first place or have home ice in the first round, that pressure's going to come back. Maybe it's not Capitals Cup contender, but if these guys are close to, maybe not close to winning the President's Trophy or close to what they like, but if this is a first place team, I don't know how the pressure doesn't come back at these guys in April, and reminding them of all the playoff failures in the past decade, and reminding them how they haven't been able to beat the Penguins. It just feels like we're headed back to the same spot with this team, and this is a team with less talent than years past, and certainly there might be a mental advantage to saying, yeah, Tampa's the favorite, Pittsburgh's the favorite, we're going to be the underdog, and maybe we're going to hear a lot of that out of Washington in the next couple of months. But it remains that this is still one of the top teams in the league. If there's an upper echelon tier, I'd probably put Tampa, Vegas, Pittsburgh, Boston, Washington, Winnipeg, Nashville, maybe St. Louis in that group. And any of those teams could win the Stanley Cup. And so you can't say the Capitals are not being looked at this point as at least someone of a Stanley Cup contender.
Steven, sticking with the Caps, Ovechkin had 2 goals and an assist yesterday. He's up to 32 goals on the season, which is almost as many goals as he scored all of last year. You know, Drew was mentioning that, you know, maybe not enough people are talking about the Capitals and how well they've been playing this year, but have enough people been talking about the fact that Ovechkin this year, when he scored his 30th goal, that was his 13th consecutive 30-goal season. That includes the lockout year, by the way, and the fact that Ovechkin's only 10 goals away from 600 on his career.
Yeah, it's remarkable. The fact that he's able to kind of get the even strength scoring back is the reason why the Capitals, along with Braden Holtby, are at the top of the division. And then maybe last year Barry Trotz wanted to play Alex Ovechkin less, try to get him ready for the playoffs. They had so much depth of scoring and offensive talent that they could afford to do that. And that's not an option afforded to them this year. So Alex Ovechkin has been having to play a lot of minutes. He's averaging 20 minutes a game this year and producing at levels you don't see out of a 32-year-old goal scorer often. I think only Jerome Iginla has really done stuff like this in this era at this age. And we know Alex Ovechkin's the greatest goal scorer of this generation, no doubt. He's headed toward another Richard Trophy, leading the league in goals. To do it at 32, we keep wondering when's he going to fall off the cliff? When's the production going to decrease? And we haven't seen it yet. The question, again, with the Capitals and Ovechkin is always going to be not how many goals he piles up in the regular season, but does he score the goal at the right time? Does he score the goal when it matters in a crucial Game 6 or a Game 7? Because he has not been a bad playoff performer as much as he gets that rap. He's been a point-a-game guy in the playoffs. But when the Capitals need a big goal, when they probably play the Penguins in the second round and probably are in a Game 7 again, instead of getting shut out last year, does Alex Ovechkin score that one goal or those 2 goals then? And then we can stop talking about how many he's putting up now and how few trips to the Eastern Conference Final he has.
Steven, one of the deepest teams in the Central was the Nashville Predators. And, you know, oftentimes teams make tweaks to the lineup, add a player at the trade deadline. Now, they've somehow gone and added a 18-goal scorer from last year, Mike Fisher, out of retirement, which is obviously a little unusual. But just how much of an advantage is that to get a veteran center for this, what they expect to be another deep playoff run?
Well, it certainly doesn't hurt. And this story seemed to come out of nowhere, that Mike Fisher, middle of the way through the year, it's like, hey guys, thanks for carrying the load during the first 50 games of the season. I'll take it from here, and kind of steps in for the fun of this now. And I guess at his age, could be a gigantic advantage because the Predators don't have to give up an asset now and get a second or potentially probably even the third line center, a guy who's been through this, a guy who's been in the playoffs, certainly respected among teammates. It's not like you're gonna have to worry about him fitting in chemistry-wise, and that's always a concern with deadline acquisitions. You don't know how a guy's going to fit in. You don't know how it's going to react, how players are going to react when a guy who's been playing every night is now a healthy scratch every night because everybody kind of goes down a rung on the ladder. Mike Fisher is someone who, if someone gets knocked out of the lineup, at least there's an understanding that this is Mike Fisher. This is a longtime captain of the Predators, or at least he's a couple of years captain of the Predators after Shea Weber got traded. And this is a guy who he's very well liked, and he knows the system, and he knows Peter Laviolette. It'll be interesting to see how long it takes for him to get back into playing shape, and if there's any kind of drop off from play from not playing since last June.
Last question for you, Steven, and we always appreciate your time. The maybe lost in the shuffle are the New Jersey Devils. They're having a great year. No one expected them to be a playoff team, and they've really been in the top three of the Metropolitan Division all season long. Are they getting sort of short shrift throughout the NHL, especially lost in the shadow of the Vegas Golden Knights and maybe to a bit of a lesser extent the Colorado Avalanche? Just how impressive the Devils have been this season?
Yeah, I mean, they were right alongside the Vegas start of the year. We're thinking about, I can't believe the Devils are this good. And just like with the Golden Knights, you kind of waited to see, well, when are they going to struggle? When are they going to hit a skid? And even when they hit a skid, even when they went, I believe, 2-9-2 in a 13-game stretch, they're still there. Right? And they're still likely to make the playoffs in the Metropolitan Division where every team is flawed in some way, from the Penguins to the Capitals. You look down at Columbus, Philadelphia, the Rangers, we don't know what they're going to do at the deadline, the Islanders with the John Tavares situation in Carolina. Any of those teams could make it. Any of those teams could miss it. But John Hines has done a fantastic job of getting young talent, and I'm talking not just Nico Hischier, but Jesper Bratt and Will Buescher. and plugging those guys in with Palmieri and plugging in a guy like Brian Boyle and getting these guys to mix and play well. And they've gotten very good goaltending. And we've seen that other than last year where maybe Corey Schneider took a bit of a step back. Corey Schneider's been an elite goaltender. He's been a Vezina Trophy, not finalist, but in the top five or six in voting and having great years and keep teams extremely well. And in theory, could be a 1B. He might be a guy who can target as a starter next year. But they've done the kind of goaltending. I think John Hines in the first year consideration, but he's got to be in it right now because the expectations on the Devils were not very high. But they've just added a lot of excitement in the summer, the Marcus Johansson trade, Nico Hischier, obviously, and it's mixed together very well. And you don't know what's going to happen come playoff time. But this is a cool story to see the Devils playing as well as they are.
Stephen Wino covers the NHL for the Associated Press. Stephen, always appreciate your time and your insight. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
And happy National Golden Retriever Day to Shadow.
Thank you very much. He's already celebrating.
Stephen, thank you again, buddy.
Thanks, guys. Talk to you soon.
When we come back, we look at some of the latest rumors about the trade deadline upcoming. We're going to play the Trade Center match game that our good buddy Frank Saravelli debuted earlier this week on TSN.ca. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, Winnipeg's longest-running sports show as part of Industrial Metals Winnipeg Jets Game Day, live on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast,
on TSN1290.ca.
Green trying to muscle past. Here comes Larkin again. Back to Green. The turn of the net. Green the shot. And he scores. Tom Shelf over the glove of Bryce. Mike Green has given the Red Wings a two-goal lead.
Ten minutes before the top of the hour, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. We're part of Industrial Metals Winnipeg Jets Game Day, the Jets and the Avalanche tonight at Bell MTS Place. Hustler and Rick start us off at 3 o'clock, and then Kevin Owen Friends at 5 before a puck drop shortly after 6 in the evening. This segment of the show brought to you by our good friends at Bernstein's Deli. If you're looking for a place to watch tonight's game, it's hashtag Hockey Night at Bernstein's. Great food and drink specials, maybe even the poutine from Le Poutine Week.
It's actually La Poutine Week.
Poutine Week?
Come on. Are we going to have another French lesson?
Yeah, I need another French lesson.
But it's Le Burger Week.
It's Le Burger Week.
So you know
week,
what that means. That means the poutine is feminine. Seriously.
Your French would be correct in that assumption. I'm not sure.
I don't know if that's a passé composé, but...
I'm not sure how a food can be feminine or masculine, but anyways, Bernstein's Deli participating in La Poutine Week. So you can check out their entry or, you know, look back at Saturday's show. You heard Ezzy mauling that poor poutine to a bloody death last week. And it is a fantastic offering available at Bernstein's Deli in the Cordon Village Mall. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com.
Bernstein's Deli in French, of course, is... Le Bernstein's Deli.
So it's masculine, it's not feminine? Okay, it's hard to keep track of these things every now and then. TSN Trade Center match game. Our good buddy Frank Saravelli debuted that earlier in the week where he sort of picked out some of the popular names that are expected to be on the trade block in the next few weeks. The trade deadline coming up on the 26th of February.
Shocker, Thomas Vanek is on the list.
Thomas Vanek is on the list. We'll start with Mike Green because that's the audio we played.
And he's on the all-color team.
That's not a team. You just made that up.
John Blue, of course, in net.
Anybody else?
Who else do we have on there? Well, Patrick Maroon.
Yes. He's also on the trade bait board.
I got to think of some other ones. Well, Dustin Brown. Who else am I missing here?
I don't know. Is there a red?
There's got to be a black. There's got to be someone named Black.
Yeah, somebody's got a name. There's got to be a hockey player named Black. I don't know if there's a current
one.
Yeah,
I'll find one.
Yeah, you find that. You work on that this week.
Yeah, my dad and I put that together years ago.
You guys really need...
Along with the all-food team.
Yeah, well, we know you and Remus put together the all-food team. Yeah. Headlined now by Andre Kasha of the Anaheim Ducks.
Yep. Don't forget about Joey Kosher.
Of course, Joey Kosher. Mike Green of the currently of the Detroit Red Wings is an unrestricted free agent at season's end. Frank has four potential destinations for Mike Green: the Tampa Bay Lightning, the Toronto Maple Leafs, the Vegas Golden Knights, and then what a lot of people are thinking is the most popular one, a return back to where he began his NHL career, the Washington Capitals. Of those four, Ezzy, which one do you think has got the best fit for Mike Green?
I'd probably say the Capitals.
Yeah, and going home.
You mentioned Drew because of the familiarity. Green spent the majority of his career with the Caps. And, you know, the Lightning, I can see that. You know, that's obviously going to be a buyer prior to the NHL trade deadline. I don't know necessarily that the Lightning need Mike Green. I mean, Mike Green, you know, everyone thinks of him as an offensive defenseman, and he is. I mean, he's a guy that can, you know, contribute on your power play. He's gotten a lot better defensively as well. But the Lightning, I think, are pretty set there on defense, especially with Victor Hedman healthy now. Mikhail Sergachev is back in the lineup after being a healthy scratch. And, you know, to me, you know, Toronto is an interesting one because Morgan Rielly and Nikita Zaitsev have been injured here the last few weeks, and they're going to return to the lineup. But Mike Green is definitely going to be more of that kind of third pairing guy. They've obviously got Ron Hainsey there as well. He can either be, you know, a second pairing guy or a third pairing guy. We actually saw him as a first pairing defenseman for the Penguins when they had some injuries. But for me, I'm going to go with Washington for Green.
Dave, your thoughts? Does that make the most sense to you, or do you see him maybe landing in a different destination? It seems like he's more likely than not to stay out east. I don't see Vegas necessarily being in the market for Mike Green or being the ultimate winner for him, but I guess stranger things have happened, namely the Vegas Golden Knights leading the Western Conference.
Yeah, I think the fact that Vegas Golden Knights are a buyer this year is something that nobody anticipated. But that's no, I'm kind of with Ez. I think that he could see him going back home.
Evander Kane,
of sorts.
Of course, he's expected to be on the move out of Buffalo. He's struggled as of late, hasn't had a really good month of January and February thus far. Three teams that Frank Saravelli has listed for Evander Kane are the Pittsburgh Penguins, the San Jose Sharks, and the Vancouver Canucks. I'd be surprised about the Sharks and the Canucks, for sure, because I'm not sure why the Canucks would, you know, give up an asset to a guy they could potentially sign in free agency come July 1st. The Penguins make sense because they're always looking for winger help. To me, the team that makes the most sense for Kane that isn't listed here is the Anaheim Ducks.
Yeah, that's interesting. Anaheim, we know, is one of those heavy teams. I agree with you, Drew. Obviously, there's the connection. Kane is from Vancouver. That's why I think, you know, Kane is rumored to be possibly going to Vancouver either before the trade deadline or maybe, as you mentioned, the Canucks just wait till the offseason and sign him. I don't see them trading for Kane. We'll see what happens here. I don't know why you would be giving up assets to acquire Kane, as you mentioned, when you can sign him in the offseason. Vancouver's obviously going to be a seller prior to the deadline. So for me, I mean, Pittsburgh, San Jose, I mean, San Jose guys quietly, you know, they're still in the playoff hunt here right now. You know, they're battling with the likes of the LA Kings and the Calgary Flames right now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Kane is a guy that I could see working in San Jose. Pittsburgh, you know, when you're talking about Kane, he obviously is a guy that you can probably put on your first or second line. He's speedy. The Penguins are a speedy team, so what do they have to give up? He'd be a rental, as far as I'm concerned. I don't think the Penguins would trade for Kane and then sign him long-term. So I could see Pittsburgh working. And, you know, you mentioned the Anaheim Ducks, Drew. I don't know if the Ducks need Evander Kane right now. They're playing really well, and you know, Kane is a guy that, you know, again, you're going to have to possibly give up a draft pick or some prospects. And, you know, if you're the Ducks right now and, you know, Getzlaff and Kessler are back in the lineup, they're playing really well.
Somebody to fill in for, I mean, Patrick Eaves was supposed to be one of your top wingers all season long.
I can see that. And as we talked about, Kane kind of plays, you know, that same physical type game that the Ducks love. We just saw that here against the Jets not too long ago. And, you know, Kane's a fast guy. And I wouldn't say that the Ducks are one of the fastest teams in the league, especially when you're talking about some of the slower kind of physical player guys like Corey Perry. So I could see Kane going to Anaheim, and I think, you know, we've talked about this now for what, a month. Mm-hmm. Kane is going to be the most sought after guy at the trade deadline, I believe. So I think you could probably add, you know, another six teams to this list.
Certainly. Dave, anything on
that? Well, I was going to say, I think the interesting or the irony would be, of course, if the Jets faced the Ducks somehow in the first round and Evander Kane was going against his old team. Yeah. I think it would be for a wonderful storyline, in addition to the fact that the Jets and the Ducks would be doing battle again.
Certainly. I mean, I've talked about the Ducks for the last few weeks. They're the team that is,
I don't think anybody wants to play them.
Nobody wants to play them. They're my sort of sleeper team coming out of the West right now. Of course, still early in that front. Maybe one or two more players before we have to head to break. Mike Hoffman of the Ottawa Senators, he's rumored to be on the block, a guy I really like. Frank Saravelli has his three potential destinations listed as the Carolina Hurricanes, the Edmonton Oilers, and the New Jersey Devils. I mean, he's not a rental, so he's got term left on his contract. That's why the Oilers would be listed there, because they're certainly looking for a trigger man, somebody who can play alongside Connor McDavid. He's certainly a skilled goal scorer. Where do you think the Senators end up trading Mike Hoffman, and what do you think about Carolina, Edmonton, and New Jersey as potential destinations?
I think there is a good chance chance that they trade Mike Hoffman. And we'll ask Marc Dumont at 11:30. He's in Ottawa, and he would know better than anybody whether or not there's a good chance that Hoffman gets traded. But I think Carolina is a good fit, Drew. We know that the Hurricanes have trouble scoring goals. I mean, their strength is that group of defensemen they have there, top four with the likes of Justin Falk and Jacob Slavin and Brett Pesce, Noah Hanifin. They've got a great top four, top six there. Mm-hmm. So for me, I mean, I don't see Edmonton being a destination. Edmonton's going to be a seller, if anything, at the trade deadline. Maybe they'd be better advised to just do nothing with some of the trades they've done over the last couple of years. But, New Jersey, I could see that. New Jersey's a quick, offensive-minded team. I could see Hoffman being a potential rental. Maybe they even end up trading and signing Mike Hoffman. So for me, Carolina and the Devils make more sense than Edmonton.
We will, of course, circle back to this list and the rest of the trade bait list throughout the month of February, as we're almost about 3 weeks away. It'll be 3 weeks on Monday away from the NHL trade deadline. Twitter user Casey at the Bat informs us that the 9th anniversary gift is pottery. So I expect that both you and Dave will be acting out the scene from Ghost later on in the show. With one of you being Patrick Swayze, and one of you can be, I guess, the other character in the movie whose name I don't remember.
It was, what's her name? Wasn't it Demi?
Was it Demi Moore?
Was it Demi Moore?
Demi Moore?
I don't know.
Drew, have a demi-glazed donut.
Now you're talking. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Josh Smith from ScoutingTheRefs.com. Talk a little bit about some of the officiating issues throughout the NHL. Hour number three of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show starts now on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
Shortly after the top of the hour, Saturday morning here on TSN 1290, this is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Drew Mandel, Ezra Ginsberg, Dave Minuk with you in studio as part of Industrial Metals Winnipeg Jets Game Day. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and of course our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From ScoutingTheRefs.com, we're pleased to welcome back to the program Josh Smith. Josh, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure, Josh. Obviously, a lot to talk about with regard to officiating, video review, things of that nature throughout the NHL. And obviously, the focus of that here was here in Winnipeg on Thursday night with what happened between the Golden Knights and the Jets. Before we get into Thursday night's incident and we get your opinion on it, Josh, has the NHL or the NHL general managers who put video review into place in the first place, have they sort of handed a hand grenade to the officials with all the uncertainty they've created with regard to introducing video review?
I think what you look at with the goaltender interference especially, you look at real-time plays, you look at calls that are made real-time from the angle that the referee has, and for better or worse, it is what it is, right? We see the obvious one, same thing with offside. If it's obvious, we see it, and maybe we question the guy after the fact, but the teams move on, the game moves on, and we know calls are missed. I think with replay, it puts everything under a microscope, not only for everybody to break it down, but to say, you gave these referees a second chance to look at it. Why should we think a guy is going to overturn his own call? And then, you're critiquing not only the call in real time, but the interpretation. So I think it puts it under a microscope where now we're at the point where we're dissecting these calls frame by frame, slow motion, multiple angles. I think it's far more than the league intended to come out of this. I think they looked at it as an opportunity to make the right call. And I think we're looking at it with such a fine focus that it's hard to even know what the right call is.
Josh, sticking with, that goal, that controversial goal from Thursday night's game between the Jets and the Golden Knights, did you think, based on what you've seen and, I guess, read about, that call, do you think that the refs explained the call well to the Golden Knights and the Jets?
I think that's one of the biggest challenges. I don't think that the call was necessarily explained well, and I think that's one of the opportunities that the league has, especially with the review process, is to provide an explanation. When you're going to review, tell them whether the call on the ice was a goal or not a goal, and then let everybody know more than just after review it's a goal. Why was it a goal? Why wasn't it a goal? What happened in the play that you were taking a look at? I know they like to keep it pretty vague and just announce the outcome, but I think everyone would have a better understanding of where the line was and what these guys were looking at with a better explanation. We saw George Parros, I know it's a separate issue, but come out and talk about the suspension for Cogliano and give some extra color around the thought process. And I think if they did that for some of these reviews, especially the high-profile ones, like Hall's goal the other night, just to let us know a little more about what went into the decision, I think it would go a long way.
So, Josh, in that vein, do you think that's something we should be hearing directly from the refs, or is that more of a refing association type of question or a response, I should say?
I'd love to hear it directly from the refs. And, from conversations I've had, I think some would love to be able to deliver that, even if it's not a Q&A with reporters, but even just to provide a statement after the game or through the officiating manager. You know, we have some of the retired officials, Koharski's one of them, Dvorsky, have one of those guys deliver the messaging. You know, this is what they looked at. This is what they saw. This is what they liked and didn't like. I'd love for it to come from the refs. I'd be happy if it came from the managers. I'd just like to hear it so that everyone could understand what went into those decisions.
Josh Smith is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Josh runs a great officiating website called scoutingtherefs.com. You know, Josh, in the 80s and the 90s, the referees were so well known. Carey Fraser, Don Koharski, you know, we knew the officials. We knew a bit of their personalities. The officials on Thursday night for the Jets Golden Knights game were Kelly Sutherland and Ghislaine Hébert. Sutherland, a veteran of 1,113 games. Hébert, you know, fewer games, 470. Four games. What's the reputation of these two officials? Does that factor in at all to their decision to not overturn the goaltender interference or not rule it goaltender interference and the missed call, the missed slashing call that preceded the goaltender interference challenge?
Well, I think Sutherland's one of the league's top officials. He's been a great ref for a long time. He's one of the league's best communicators on the ice. He's one of the most clear and most conversational. If you hear a mic'd up game with him, you're going to hear him chatting all day long, talking to the guys, letting them know what's a penalty, what's not a penalty, when they're getting close to the line there. So he's terrific in both his calls and his communication. I think with the specifics around this, with the missed slash, it was a missed slash. You know, I originally tweeted out when I saw the goal that Ghislaine Hébert was in great position to see that the puck was loose behind Connor Hellebuyck. He was right behind the goal line. It was perfect to see the puck, and it was the worst possible spot to see that slash from James Neal. So he didn't see the slash real time, and I think we can live with that. When you're reviewing it, though, after the fact, and you're looking for goaltender interference, you can't go back and call the penalty. That's not permitted. Any of the reviews for any reason, you can't go back and assess a penalty on the play. It was a missed slash, fine. But you have to look at the impact of that slash, and was that slash goaltender interference? I think it's hard to argue that a slash to the helmet is not in some way impairing the goaltender from being able to do his job, and Hellebuyck was squarely in the crease. So I don't know how you don't see that as interfering with the goaltender's ability to make a save on the play.
You know, Josh, getting away from Eric Halla's controversial goal on Thursday night and talking about another controversial incident on Thursday night, and I saw that you wrote about it on scoutingtherefs.com. That was Radko Gudas and his hit on Kyle Palmieri. Of course, the Flyers and Devils were the two teams playing, and the referee on the ice was Tim Peel. He made the interference call on Radko Gudas, and then the NHL announced that they wouldn't be giving Radko Gudas any type of supplemental discipline. And, of course, he's a guy that has a history of suspensions and fines. Is this a case where the referee and the NHL got it right?
You know, everybody wants to go after Gudas. Anytime somebody goes down, you're looking at Gudas, and you think that he's done something wrong. And historically, he probably has. In this case, though, I think they did get it right. I think Peel's call, it was an interference. He did interfere with a guy who wasn't playing the puck at the time. But after a review and looking at it from other angles, Gudas was trying to get around Wayne Simmonds, and I don't think he was expecting the Devils player to be there. The problem is nobody's expecting Gudas to rush up ice, and when he does, he's not the most agile guy. So I think it was maybe a misguided attempt of getting out of the way. Leaping through the air is not something I'd recommend. But when he's doing it, obviously it draws much more attention than when another guy or even a smaller guy does the same thing. So I think they did get it right, but I think fans are inclined not to give Gudas the benefit of the doubt at this point based on his history.
You know, at the state of the All-Star, AHL All-Star conversation with Dave Andrews, he was talking about the AHL and how they're going to move to a two-referee system. So what does that say to you, Josh, about the depth of the pool now that you can draw from, that the AHL can have all their games being reffed now by two refs as opposed to just one?
I think it's a great sign. I mean, it's always a concern at lower levels of having enough officials, whether it's minors, junior, amateur hockey. It's hard. It's a hard world out there for somebody to be a referee and put up with what they have to put up to work their way up the ladder. You know, we see the ECHL with their three-man system, and they're continually trying to develop. So it's definitely a good sign to see that the AHL is moving forward and able to implement that two-man system full-time. That's what we're looking at in the NHL. The NHL is always working to find that pool. So you're pulling more guys in. I think there will be some guys who this year didn't make the AHL that next year will, simply because there's more openings and there's a maturity and a learning process that's going to take place. So I think it's good for development. You know, like you said, like with expansion, you get guys that maybe wouldn't be in the league this year that are going to be in it. So they'll have some refs and some linesmen that might have to pick things up a little bit more. But certainly a better pool for the NHL to draw from and to analyze that talent in a consistent environment in the AHL. So I think it's a great sign, and hopefully we'll continue to encourage that at lower levels.
Josh Smith, our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, Josh Wren, scoutingtherefs.com. Josh, sort of along the same lines as Dave's question, you know, how often are referees downgraded? That they're, you know, maybe at the end of the season or midway through the year, they're deemed not suitable for the NHL level. How often does that happen where a guy sort of reaches the limits to his capabilities, you know, as an official?
In the NHL, we don't really see that from a tenured official. I'll give an exception, and it's not a downgrade at all, but we will see some of the guys that are nearing the end of their careers that'll pick up some games in the AHL merely to help mentor the younger guys. We saw Tom Kowal working with Evgeny Romasko, and they worked a few games in the NHL together, and then they went down to the AHL to work a pair and then came back up to work in the NHL. So we see that. As far as any demotions, once you're past, you know, third or fourth year, and once you're full-time in the NHL, you're more or less locked into your spot. The places we do see it are with the AHL, NHL guys, the guys that will split duty between the leagues. And, you know, sometimes it works out and they get promoted to full time, and some just happen not to stick. You know, we lost a few. John Grant, linesman, he'd split time between the leagues and he was released. So he's now working lower levels. We saw Darcy Burchell a couple years ago. So once they're full time, they're pretty much set. It's the part timers that are really being evaluated to determine whether they can stay and whether they'll make a full-time career as an NHL official.
Josh, one last question for you here. I know that you're aware of this. A lot of people probably aren't aware of this, but referee Dave Jackson, this is going to be his final year reffing in the NHL. He's one of only six referees to work 1,500-plus games. As the season comes to an end here, we've still got, obviously, you know, over 2 months left, but as the season progresses, are we going to be expecting more and more teams to be honoring Dave Jackson and all the fine work that he's done throughout his career as an NHL ref?
You know, it'd be nice to see it, just a mention. I'm not expecting much, maybe outside of his hometown of Montreal and his current home in Colorado, to see a few things there maybe as he's on his way out the door. But I know the league doesn't like to focus too much on the official, so probably not a lot on this this farewell tour. I am expecting to have a few more retirements coming up later this year, so we'll see who else is on their way out. But you know, definitely nice for Jackson's announcement to be out there, get a chance for him to work an All-Star game in his final season, which I know for him was important that his kids got to see him work it, which really a nice honor from the league, and great to throw him in the All-Star game alongside their viral All-Star Wes McCauley.
Yeah, Josh, not to make a liar out of Ezzy, but I actually have one more question for you. You know,
sure.
If you look at the NFL, they sort of have the same officiating crew works all together throughout the regular season. They have All-Star crews in the playoffs, but that's a separate issue for another day and time. MLB has sort of umpire crews that travel around, and they switch, obviously, from what base they umpire on a game-by-game basis. Should the NHL do more to keep sort of officials and linesmen together for a longer period of time throughout the course of the season, as opposed to just sort of bringing in one guy here, one guy there, and just sort of almost forcing them together?
You know, there's always pros and cons for it. I think you get some familiarity and the guys get used to each other. And I think the NHL's stance has been that they want their guys to be interchangeable. They don't want a tendency of one official to carry through with another. So if they keep moving them around, they can try for greater consistency because you're more or less averaging them out, or you're getting them not too comfortable with any given partner. We do see in the playoffs, for each round, they do pairings. So we'll see the refs paired up and the linesmen paired up, and they'll rotate around. So obviously the NHL sees value in doing it. I think for the grind of the season, though, they want to compare and see how people do with different partners throughout the season. Like I said, there's pros and cons with as many games as these guys are working. It's probably nice to have a change of scenery and a change of partners on the ice versus the NFL, where you've got a relatively short schedule and games only once a week. So I look forward to those pairings and those matchups in the postseason, and that's where we can really see them filter out their top guys and who should work together and which guys move on.
Josh Smith covers the world of officiating for ScoutingTheRefs.com. Josh, always appreciate your time and insight. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, thanks, guys. Enjoy the games today.
Our pleasure, Josh. Thanks again. When we come back, we look at 25 years of Gary Bettman as NHL commissioner. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
For a league that craves headlines in the United States, this was a disaster. 5 months to the day after he locked the players out, the NHL commissioner threw away the key.
It is no longer practical to conduct even an abbreviated season. Accordingly, I have no choice but to announce the formal cancellation of play for 2004-2005.
Gary Bettman making the historic, well, for all the wrong reasons, historic announcement back that he was the first commissioner presiding over the first league to cancel an entirety of a season. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. That, of course, was the 04-05 season. Amazing to think we're now 25 years into the term of Gary Bettman as NHL commissioner. That anniversary happened a couple days ago. He first took office back on February 1st, 1993. This segment of the show brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, officially declared the funniest place in Winnipeg by Illegal Curve Hockey. For over 30 years, so longer than Gary Bettman has been NHL commissioner, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. Tonight at Rumors, his final night in town, two great shows, 7:15 and 10 p.m. Graham Clark in town. Get your tickets available right now, rumorscomedyclub.com. And of course, a special concert series event just announced featuring Drew Lynch from America's Got Talent. That's coming up early in May. Tickets available for all upcoming shows, rumorscomedyclub.com. 25 years of Gary Bettman, Ezzy. What's his legacy? No matter how long he lasts as commissioner, is the first thing written on his tombstone always going to be that he canceled the 04-05 season?
Well, I mean, the lockouts were definitely probably over the last 25 years, were probably the worst parts of his tenure as commissioner of the National Hockey League. It's not just him that created these lockouts. I mean, for me, I mean, Gary Bettman, there have been good moments and bad moments. Obviously, probably, you know, the best moments of his tenure as commissioner of the National Hockey League have been his ability to grow revenue and expand the league. I mean, look at the Vegas Golden Knights. I mean, the owners are probably not going to tell you that they're pretty happy that, you know, they have $500 million to share amongst them. But when you look at, you know, the 25 years as a whole, obviously, Drew, the lockouts were not something that hockey fans liked. But, I mean, they were almost necessary, especially the last one. And, you know, 2004-2005, I mean, that was probably the worst year for hockey fans. There was no NHL hockey. Mm-hmm. But the growth of the game, especially in non-traditional markets, you know, Arizona, it's been a debacle, sure. But, you know, a lot of those teams have grown. You look at the Tampa Bay Lightning, the Los Angeles Kings, the Anaheim Ducks. You know, they've won Stanley Cups, and the game has grown in those markets. So there is good and bad. And, I mean, Greg Wyshynski wrote about this for ESPN.com. It was a really good article if you haven't checked it out. And, obviously, the Jets have come back under Gary Bettman's watch. I mean, but, again, there's a lot of bad things. The NBC deal TV deal was not a good television deal. So, I mean, you could point out all of these different areas. I mean, it's a tough job. And for me, what's probably going to be the most interesting is to see how much longer Gary Bettman is going to be the NHL commissioner. I'm not saying that he's going to retire anytime soon, but he's not getting any younger.
No, he said that he's going to be commissioner through the next labor negotiations at least, which will, you know, when you talk labor negotiations in the NHL, it invariably means lockout, unfortunately. So maybe he can avoid that, and that'll be, you know, sort of his swan song as NHL commissioner, Dave.
You know what? I mean, the fact of the matter is, if you're an owner in the NHL, you love Gary Bettman. And while the fans might, some fan bases, some segments within the population might not like him, he went from a league that generated $400 million annually to $5 billion. The average salary of a player went from $370,000 to $3.2 million. So there are at least 600-plus players, and there are at least, you know, 31 owners yeah. who are extremely happy with the job he's doing. And the reality is, as we all know, the really people that matter to Gary Bettman are the 31 owners, because that's the people that employ him. So to me, that's the interesting thing, is that, yeah, you know, of course, you can point to the negatives, but he's tried to grow the sport in certain ways. And, you know, we don't like the Olympic situation, of course, because we'd rather see NHL players there. To me, I kind of like the fact that he plays up the heel card. I like when we were in the draft in New Jersey and he was getting just booed like crazy. Mm-hmm. And then he goes, "You're going to want to hear this," to, you know, the fans there when they made the Corey Schneider trade with the Canucks. So he plays up that role a little bit. He kind of works the crowd pretty well. And to me, one of the most interesting things I've ever experienced, considering how disliked he was in Winnipeg from 1996 until 2011. He was probably one of the most hated people in this market. And then when we were there at the Jets' first game, mm-hmm. and he was walking through the crowd getting high fives and cheered. I mean, think about it. When you see Gary Bettman go out to an arena and present the Stanley Cup, he gets booed by every fan base. Regardless of whether they know why they're booing him, they just boo him.
They boo all the commissioners.
Right, yeah. It's become a tradition. But the funniest part was just to see the reaction in Winnipeg for a guy who was as disliked for having been seen as part of the reason why the Jets left in the first place, and then having seen when he came back, the way it was almost like he was almost uncomfortable because it thrust him into a role that he was unfamiliar with, which was one of praise and gratitude from the fan base. So I think it's interesting. I think he's got all, you know, there's pros, there's cons of him. But I mean, again, he's the commissioner and he does what is really, I mean, you could say he's the focal point of hate, but the reality is he's only doing the bidding of what the owners are telling him to do. So, I mean, he's the figurehead, but that's about it.
Is he the public face of the NHL, and is it a problem that the public face of the NHL isn't a player so much as it is the commissioner of the league? I mean, is he the most, you know, it seems to me that, I mean, he's the most prominent voice, he's the most prominent face in the world of hockey, and his shadow is even larger than that of the players who are on the ice. Isn't that a problem, Ezzy?
I don't know, but I mean, for me, he's not necessarily the face of the NHL, but he's the boss of the NHL. I mean, is Roger Goodell the face of the NFL?
Well, I think Roger Goodell, I would say Tom Brady is probably the face of the NFL, but Roger Goodell certainly is a strong personality. Maybe Peyton Manning was the face of the NHL, pardon me, the NFL alongside Tom Brady before he retired. I just don't know that I think it's a bit of maybe a black mark, not necessarily against Gary Bettman, maybe against the NHL as a whole, that they haven't created or they haven't been able to develop any personas that supersede the league itself. They haven't been able to create any crossover stars that I would think have touched the public consciousness, particularly the U.S. public consciousness.
Yeah, but I think that's just a function of the popularity of the sport. I don't think there's going to be one player who's going to somehow thrust the sport into the public eye in the States. I think hockey in the United States is always going to be one of the, you know, it'll be up there. But I mean, the reality is, go to any website in the U.S. and you see where hockey ranks. It's usually buried within the sports. So they'll have the football team, they'll have the hockey team, they'll have the basketball team, you know, as key buttons. And then when you look, you have to search within the sports drop down menu to get to hockey. So, I mean, that's just the way hockey is regarded in the U.S. I don't think it has anything to do with Gary Bettman. And, you know, I mean, if you think about it, for many years, Bud Selig was the head of baseball. Everybody knew who Bud Selig was. And basketball was, what's his name, David
Stern.
And, I mean, again, these guys just have their personalities, and because they are the heads of the league and they are you know, prevalent in negotiations, and you see them. So I don't think that's, to me personally, I don't know if I agree with that. I just think that's just a function of the way commissioners in sport are. I think that you know who they are because they're seen. That's just a function of their jobs.
Well, in Greg Wyshynski's article that Ezzie referenced, he sort of goes through the good and the bad of Gary Bettman's tenure, and the last thing that he has listed on the under the bad column is that the NHL has a, you know, to your point, Dave, a niche sport status that, you know, 25 years ago, prior to Gary Bettman getting involved, the NHL had a loyal collection of fans in the U.S. but rarely broke through to the mainstream. And today you could say the exact same thing, that the NHL has a loyal collection of fans in the U.S. but rarely breaks through to the mainstream. And now maybe that's just a function of it's never going to change, and no matter who's in charge, it's never going to change. But that's something that you wonder if maybe more focus could have been put on trying to become more in the public consciousness, more of the big four as opposed to the big three and the little brother that the NHL might be, or the perception might exist that it is. Obviously, we said we don't know when Gary Bettman's tenure is going to come up. Is Bill Daly the man after Gary Bettman? Do you think it's just a natural progression that this is Bill Daly's job if he wants it after Gary Bettman?
Yeah, it's possible, or maybe they're going to retire at the same time. I'm not quite sure, but obviously Daly is someone who you would think would take over when Gary Bettman retires.
It'll be interesting to see how the next few years of Gary Bettman's tenure carries on. No sign that he's retiring, but you wonder when there's another article Kevin McGran in the Toronto Star wrote about how much Bettman enjoys spending time with his grandchildren and his wife, and you wonder when the pull of family, you know, overrides the want and the desire to spend hours upon hours and days upon days and months upon months focusing on the NHL. When is too much money? When do you get enough money that you're willing to walk off into the sunset? When we come back, Mark Dumont of TheAthletic.com joins us. We'll talk about the Montreal Canadiens, talk about the Ottawa Senators, talk about those two teams out of the playoff race and their plans for the upcoming NHL trade deadline. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
Bottom of the hour, Saturday morning. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live here on TSN 1290 as part of Industrial Metals Winnipeg Jets Game Day. Drew Mindell, Ezra Ginsberg, Dave Minuk with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio. That's IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From TheAthletic.com, we're pleased to welcome to the program Mark Dumont. Mark, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on. I won't be slashing anyone in the helmet, though, so don't worry. I'm not a big James Neal fan.
Don't worry, it's not a penalty. You can slash.
No, that was a good goal, clearly.
Yeah, slash away to your heart's content, Mark.
And not just a slash. I mean, that stick broke and went flying, what, 10 feet up in the air?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he got his money's worth. If you're going to get away with a slashing infraction, you might as well get your money's worth, and James Neal certainly did that.
I think the referees in general, and I know many people will disagree with me, I think they usually do a good job, but it's gotten to the point now that I don't think a single person knows what goaltender interference is in the NHL.
The fans certainly don't, the coaches certainly don't, and the fact that the officials certainly don't really is a problem that the league, I heard a lot of criticism yesterday that Gary Bettman, if this was an issue in the NFL or an issue in the NBA, the commissioner would have stepped in and resolved it already. I'm not sure how much belief I have about that because we still don't know what a catch is in the NFL. But, Gary Bettman was getting some criticism for not solving this problem, certainly during at least the All-Star break, aside from issuing a memo.
Yeah, well, I think the NHL focused on the wrong thing this summer because they tried to fix the offside rule when I thought it was perfectly fine as it is, so... You know the old saying, if it ain't broke, definitely try to fix it.
Mark Dumont from TheAthletic.com joins us. Mark, shifting over to the Montreal Canadiens, where you spend a lot of your time, it's certainly a lost season in Montreal at this point in time. They're scratching and clawing to stay out of the basement in the Eastern Conference. Fortunately, there's the Senators and the Sabres that make the Habs look better. trade deadline about 3 weeks away. You know, we've heard the talk about Max Pacioretty already. We've heard the talk about pending UFA Thomas Plekanec. We've heard the talk all season long about Alex Galchenyuk. What does Marc Bergevin do at the trade deadline? Do you expect him to be active? Do you expect him to try and overhaul this roster? I mean, you can't really tear it down to rebuild because you have Shea Weber and Carey Price on those lengthy contracts. It seems like the Habs are the definition of between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there. If you consider trading Pacioretty, what you're doing is that you're trading one of the best even strength goal scorers in the NHL, well, the best, not named Ovechkin, over the last 5 years, from a team that struggles to score. So you have a team that historically has an issue putting the puck in the net, and you're trading one of the best goal scorers. To me, as a general manager, if you do that, you're essentially raising the white flag. And if you're going to trade a guy like Max Pacioretty because you're afraid to pay him the big bucks that he's going to be worth, and keep in mind, he's only making $4.5 million this year, and he has been for the last 5 years. Well, then you absolutely have to consider trading a guy like Shea Weber, who will be 33 years old. But Marc Bergevin, the way he's approaching this right now is that there's three guys he doesn't want to move. His goalie that's about to make $10.5 million, his aging defenseman that's going to make $8 million, and a young defenseman called Victor Mete. So essentially, between Price and Weber next year, that's 25% of their salary cap in two players. And he still thinks that he can build around that. In my opinion, that's not going to work unless you get better defensemen in the mix. The forwards aren't the issue for the Canadiens. I know that sounds crazy to say. They're not scoring, but they're not the issue. The problem is the Canadiens can't get the puck up the ice with control. So it doesn't matter how good your forwards are if your defense can't move the puck up the ice. You know, your forwards are essentially going to be neutered. You're mitigating the value. And that's the biggest problem for the Canadiens right now. You have Carl Alner, who signed until 2022 for way too much money. And they got rid of all their puck-moving defensemen. So a rock and a hard place is a really good way to put it. The good news is they can sit on Pacioretty for now. He still has another year at $4.5 million. The only guy that they can look at moving or that they really should push to move right now is obviously Thomas Plekanec. Other than him, you can look at a guy like Paul Byron, but I think he has more value for the Canadiens. He's a guy that can put up 20 goals, makes about $1.5 million. I know some teams would be interested, but I don't think you're going to get fair value back for him. So I don't expect them to be overly busy at the trade deadline. That being said, Marc Bergevin is impossible to predict. I didn't think they'd trade Sergachev. I didn't think they'd trade PK Subban. I never thought that they'd even consider trading Max Pacioretty. And these are all things that have come to the surface. So you never know with Marc Bergevin.
Mark, if you're a Montreal Canadiens fan, what are you optimistic about right now? Because as you mentioned, the Habs traded Mikhail Sergachev, their first-round pick, ninth overall from back in 2016. And you also mentioned Victor Mete. He's had a nice rookie year for the Habs, and the future is very bright for him. Ryan Poling was their first-round pick last year. He's, of course, playing college hockey right now, but what's there to be excited for as a Habs fan, aside from Carey Price?
The rough part is, even Carey Price lately hasn't been a source of much enthusiasm for Montreal Canadiens fans. I think the way to look at it in a positive light is that at the upcoming draft, pending how many more picks they add to their lot, but as it stands right now, they'll have a good first-round pick, probably top five, and then they have three second-round picks. That can do wonders to revitalize your prospect pool because, as you mentioned, there's not much to look forward to when your team's bad, and the Canadiens arguably have one of the worst prospect pools in the NHL. So, you know, it's kind of a double whammy there. I think fans can look towards possibly a regime change, although from what I've heard, for all intents and purposes, Marc Bergevin will be back next year. But even with him at the helm, you have about 10 or 12 prospects that'll join the fold this summer. And that, at least, I know it takes a long time for them to make it up, but that's your first step. That's where you need to take, you know, and you got to stop prioritizing size, grit, intensity over stuff like skill and pure raw talent. So hopefully the Canadiens can get back and add half a dozen really talented players to their prospect pool and maybe another five or six guys that can hopefully make it down the line.
Well, you know, Mark, that leads perfectly into my question because the eyes of Manitoba were focused on Place Belle last weekend during the NHL All-Star break because, of course, the Moose were in Laval to play the Rocket for the first time since they've moved there. Number one, how much does Montreal like having the their farm team now only 30 minutes away? And more importantly, it seems like the Rocket have really been embraced within the Laval community. I know that their attendance-wise, they've been doing pretty well.
Yeah, they're averaging almost 7,000 fans per game, which you might think, okay, well, Laval is actually off the island, right? It's not right, it's right beside Montreal, but it's not actually touching. So you do have to take a subway or a highway to get there. The fact that they're pulling in that many fans in a city near Montreal is very encouraging because minor hockey around Montreal has failed. Every hockey in the province of Quebec, other than the Montreal Canadiens, has failed at one point or another. We talk about Montreal being this great hockey town. It's a Montreal Canadiens town. That's what it is. So seeing 7,000 people show up on a game night where they're, you know, the Habs are also playing is very encouraging. I spoke to Larry Carrière. He's the general manager of the team. And he said, listen, we wouldn't have done this if we wouldn't have put the focus on families. And that's what they're doing. That's what's making them so successful in terms of attendance. That's why they're a top five team in attendance, is that families can go. For $100, you can get 5 tickets, parking, a couple beers, and, you know, 2 hot dogs. Whereas in an NHL rink, that might get you one of the worst tickets, about 300 feet up on the last row. So it's really focused on families. And I think that's important nowadays. We've kind of priced families out of the NHL experience, which is unfortunate. I remember my father bringing me to the Montreal Forum when I was a kid. I still have the stub. It was a great ticket, and it was $24. So, you know, you don't see that anymore, and that's why it's been so important to the community and for the team itself. Hey, I love the people in St. John's. They're fantastic fans, but you just cut the distance from a few thousand kilometers to 20 minutes, and that's just such a boon. For example, Nikita Sherbak, he came in this morning. If he had to come in from St. John's, he wouldn't have been available today. It would have taken him an extra day. So it just makes the logistics behind it so much simpler for the Montreal Canadiens, and that's why they invested so much money in that $200 million AHL rink. And it's a gorgeous rink. If anyone has a chance to come to Montreal, if you can't get tickets for the Habs, go to a Laval Rocket game. Great atmosphere, great rink. It's nicer than some NHL rinks I've been to.
Mark Dumont of TheAthletic.com is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show discussing the Montreal Canadiens. And Mark, you mentioned Nikita Sherbak. He gets called up by the Habs. He's going to play his third game of the season. He's you know, had a very good year in the AHL, over a point a game for the Rocket. What are the expectations for the former first-round pick back in 2014?
First of all, I wanted to mention, did you guys watch the Laval Rocket versus Manitoba game by any chance?
I caught some of it. I was listening on the radio primarily.
I think Nick Petan might have made the nicest assist I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah,
I don't know if you guys got a chance to take a look at that highlight.
Oh yeah, he's been doing that all season long. But yeah, no, I saw your tweet. Oh, it was
gorgeous pass. If anyone gets a chance to look at it, you know, between the legs, direct, strong, fast pass. So for Sherbak, the interesting thing here is that he's so creative. And what they did is that they put him on a line today. He's going to be playing beside Jonathan Drouin and Alex Galchenyuk. So Claude Julien, who's always been worried about defense, basically, you know, threw it out to the wind and said, hey, guys, it's time to score. You know, it doesn't matter how well you defend if you're not scoring. The Canadians have gone into the first period without a goal 20-some times this year. So, you know, they simply can't score any goals, and it might as well see what these guys can do. I think it's a nice reward for Sherbak, and I like the idea of placing a young, talented player with skilled line mates. It never made sense to me that you're going to get this guy that's always played on the power play, first line, his entire career, and then you're going to put him with pluggers on the fourth line, taking defensive zone shifts. That isn't conducive for a young player to create in the NHL. So this is a huge opportunity for Nikita Sherbak. And considering the Canadians are in such a tumultuous time right now, I think it's a really good opportunity for him to maybe carve out a little niche on the team and say, you know, hey, look at me. I'm worth sticking with going forward. His contract's up this summer, so it'll be interesting to see what they do with that. But now they actually get to see what he can do with talented line mates, and that is key.
Mark, you reside in Ottawa, so we got to ask you about the Senators too, and they're a team that isn't going to make the playoffs, similar to the Canadiens. And you know, earlier in the show, we talked about Mike Hoffman, a guy who you know is rumored to be possibly on the move. If you're Pierre Dorion, do you have to look at moving guys like Mike Hoffman and Derek Brassard? I don't think there's any chance they're going to trade a player like Mark Stone, a pending RFA. But if you're Pierre Dorion, do you have to make some moves prior to February 26?
I think the key here is you have to decide what you're going to do with Eric Carlson. If Eric Carlson gets moved, which would probably be a huge mistake, I don't think there's a single team that's traded away a Norris-winning defenseman and has come out of it saying, hey, we're glad you were happy about that trade. So if you're going to keep Eric Carlson, which is probably the right call, I think you have to surround him with talent, guys like Hoffman. He's not going to want to re-sign long-term on a team that's not going to be competitive. So if you start trading away guys like Hoffman, who's really underrated, I think you're essentially signaling to him that, A, you don't have the funds and you don't have the vision that this team can compete. So essentially it puts your captain and your best player in doubt. To me, what the Senators desperately need to do is shed some salary. You're looking at guys like Bobby Ryan at $7 million, Dion Phaneuf at, 7.5 million? That's the big money they need to get rid of. If you're worried about paying Eric Carlson $12 million, but you're still paying Phaneuf and Bobby Ryan $14-15 combined, I think you're basically, you know, you're not seeing the forest for the trees there. You're missing a little bit of foresight. So to me, it's all about what they want to do with Carlson. If they're keeping him, then you've got to keep guys like Hoffman. You absolutely have no choice. If you're trading him, then you have guys like Hoffman or Stone, sorry, that's 25, Shane that's 26. By the time the return from Carlson comes into play, that's what, 4 years down the road, those first-round picks start to actually turn into something? Well, you lost your core anyway. So the Senators are in a pretty bad position as well. But to me, I think you just have to commit to your goal, your defenseman, who teams fight to get a guy like that. Teams go 30 years without getting a defenseman like Carlson. And I guarantee you, if they move him, the next question will be, where can we find another Eric Carlson?
Mark, going back to Laval, is there anybody that Montreal can look to bring up from there that may be able to give them a little bit of a shot in the arm?
The sad part is not really. There's two guys, other than Chirbeck, there's two guys. One is Charlie Lindgren. He's a goalie that used to play for St. Cloud State. Very good, but you know, you're not going to get a huge upgrade on Carey Price there. The other one is Noah Jolson. He used to play with the Everett Silvertips in the WHL. A very, very smooth skating defenseman, makes a lot of good plays. He's great at preventing controlled entries in his own zone. So instead of defending in his own zone, he stops players from getting there in the first place. He's great at transitioning the puck up the ice, which is something the Canadiens desperately need. So I look at Noah Jolson. He was their 2015 first-round pick, I believe, as a guy that can maybe give him a little more youthful exuberance. But unfortunately for the Canadiens, that's about it. And when you're one of the worst teams in the league and you look at the AHL team and you have maybe one or two guys that can possibly make the jump, it's a pretty bad situation.
It's slim pickings for Canada's two most eastern NHL teams. Mark Dumont from TheAthletic.com, thanks very much for joining us and for your insight into the Habs and the Senators. Have a great Saturday.
Thanks a lot, guys. Have a good one. Thanks for having me on.
When we come back, one final segment, we'll wrap up the program, get you set for this evening's Avs-Jets game, and maybe a little brass bonanza for you. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're part of Industrial Metals Winnipeg Jets game day on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN1290.ca.
One final segment this Saturday morning here on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A big thank you to all of the guests who joined us. We had Josh Smith from ScoutingTheRefs.com, Mark Dumont from TheAthletic.com, of course, Lauren Gardner, Colorado Avalanche studio host and reporter for Altitude Sports, Stephen Wino from the Associated Press, and way back in the first hour, we had Mike McIntyre from the Winnipeg Free Press. In case you missed any of the show, any of the interviews, any of the celebrations of our ninth year on air, it's available for download on iTunes. You can download it on tsn1290.ca or just subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and it'll be made available for you shortly after the show concludes. News from the Carolina Hurricanes world is that they are now embracing their Hartford Whalers history. It's been years now since the Carolina Hurricanes were the Hartford Whalers, and for the longest time, owner Peter Karmanos wanted nothing to do with the whale. Nothing to do with their logo, nothing to do with Brass Bonanza, which is playing underneath us right now. New ownership, new philosophy. Tom Dundon, the new owner of the Hurricanes, coming in and embracing the history of the franchise way back at its Connecticut roots. Did he err in not doing this earlier? Pardon me, did Karmanos, Peter Karmanos, err in not embracing the Hartford Whalers segment of the history?
I don't know. I mean, like, I guess he wanted to create a whole new, you know, environment. So they initially tried to break from the history of the original franchise. I mean, I personally love the Whaler jersey, love everything about the Whalers. So, I mean, you know, whenever you see that in any building, it's always kind of like nostalgic for you. It's similar to the way the Jets used to be, the Quebec Nordiques, that sort of thing. But yeah, something special about those Hartford Whalers, almost the lovable losers sort of thing. So, no, I think it was probably a... It was probably a by design, but I like the fact that they're kind of going back to the traditions of the Hartford Whalers.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting, Ezzy, that, you know, I can understand, you know, maybe for the first few years in Carolina, you want to establish your own brand and your own logo, similar to what the True North did with the new Jets logo. And then it was, you know, in year five, they started to hearken back to the history of the team. I wonder if Karmanos probably, in hindsight, regrets not doing it a little bit sooner in his ownership stead, and then it's taken to a new ownership group to get involved.
Yeah, it's awesome. Everybody loves the Whalers, and, you know, it's as Dave mentioned, a big part of the history. So, you know, it's a great song, and great that the Whalers are going to be included more in the Hurricanes, you know, present day kind of game day production.
Jaromír Jágr's got 2 points today in his debut for Kladno in the Czech Elite League, of course, the team that he owns in the Czech Elite League. You know, Elliot Friedman referenced this in his 31 Thoughts article this week, that the NHL should do something in which to get Jágr back into maybe an all-star game next year, which is in San Jose. Just an opportunity for the fans to salute him for such an epic career, as opposed to having it end sort of on the down note that it did in Calgary, with him injured and no one really being able to give him the worthy salute that he deserves for what a fantastic NHL career that he had. Your thoughts on that idea?
Yeah, Jágr is one of the greatest players of all time. Everybody knows he's going to the Hockey Hall of Fame. You know, maybe you do something like, you know, teams all come out wearing, you know, 68 jerseys, obviously the number 68 on the back of their jersey, something like that. But I would have absolutely no problem, you know, with the NHL doing something league-wide, because, as you mentioned, Drew, and as I mentioned, I mean, he's one of the greatest ever.
Dave?
No, I don't. I mean, first of all, we could see him back in the NHL. You never know. I mean, maybe he maybe he recoups enough to, you know, some home cooking back in the Czech, and he feels up to playing. But no, I mean, I would have zero problem with it, obviously. I mean, he's one of the best players I've ever seen live. It's just the guy, the things he was able to do with the puck, even at an older age, but still, like, throughout his career, was simply phenomenal.
All-Star Game was last weekend. I didn't catch any of it. I'm not sure if you guys caught much of it. You know, Elliot Friedman talks about how the specialists in the NHL, the guys with the hardest shot, are generally accepted as Shea Weber and Zdeno Chara. Neither of them were All-Stars. You know, Connor McDavid was, and he's obviously the fastest skater. But that, you know, nobody, that sort of with the skills competition, it wasn't a best on best, in that you never saw the guys with the hardest shot, or you never saw the guys with the fastest skaters throughout the league going up against Connor McDavid. Do you think it's time maybe to reevaluate the skills competition as maybe getting more people involved in it, even guys who aren't technically all-stars, but getting able to see them demonstrate some of their skills alongside those who are all-stars? You know, maybe a guy, I don't know, who's a fast skater. Nikolaj Ehlers is a fast skater. Maybe get to see him going up against Connor McDavid, something like that, even though they technically might not be an all-star representative.
I like the current all-star format, and, you know, Connor McDavid is one of the fastest guys in the league, and we all expected him to win fastest skater. So it's unfortunate, you know, like, that a guy like Zdeno Chara, you know, couldn't be in the competition, but there were a lot of guys with big slap shots. You think of Brent Burns, particularly, he's got a hard shot. Alex Ovechkin's got a hard shot. Steven Stamkos. But, you know, for me, my favorite part of the NHL skills competition was the save streak, which was won by Marc-Andre Fleury. You had Pekka Rinne also, who finished second to Marc-Andre Fleury. So that was a new skills competition that they added this year. So, you know, I have no problem with the current format, but, you know, maybe they do look at bringing it back to the way it used to be.
That's it for the Saturday edition of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Big thank you to all of our guests for joining us. As I mentioned, in case you missed any of the program, it's going to be available on our website, illegalcurve.com. It's going to be available on tsn1290.ca. It's available wherever you get your podcast. Just subscribe, get it sent to you each and every week. Big thank you to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center. Linden Market Dental Center, easy for me to say, Bernstein's Deli, Zappia Group Realty, and Keener Jerseys. Support those fine local businesses because they support Illegal Curve Hockey. Big props to producer James doing a great job behind the board. For Dave Manuk and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.